Welcome to the Burden and Blessing Podcast, a study and discussion forum on the truth of God's Word. Our review series examines books, movies, music, and other media in the light of God's truth. We pray that it will be eye-opening, instructional, and beneficial for your daily walk with Christ.
I don't believe there was a single event that we can call the Exodus.
So far, there is no documented evidence about the Exodus.
Exodus did not happen in the way that it is described in the text.
How can we prove that?
You look for a collapse in Egyptian civilization, and that's where you'll find Moses and the Exodus.
Telling us that there was no Jericho at the time that Joshua conquered the promised land. Why don't we ask the simple question, when was Jericho destroyed?
Do you think this is Joseph?
Either it is Joseph or it's somebody remarkably the same.
We have tombs that are clearly those of foreigners, Semites. We can tell this by the pottery, by the kind of weapons. These are not Egyptian type daggers. They have donkeys in some cases buried with them. This was not an Egyptian practice.
This is real evidence.
Look at your evidence and come to a conclusion based on the evidence.
Patterns of Evidence, the Exodus.
That was the trailer for Patterns of Evidence, Exodus. We're going to be taking a look at a review of that movie today. Pastor Neil Radical joins me in order to discuss a little bit more about the history that we see and the archaeological evidence that has been uncovered and discovered in Egypt that verifies the Old Testament books of Genesis and Exodus. Some pretty eye-opening stuff in this video, isn't there?
Yeah, I really like the way the history comes alive when you look at the different steps of the biblical sequence, which is talked about almost right away in the beginning of this video. Mahoney, he talks about the arrival in Egypt, the multiplication, the slavery, the judgment, the deliverance from them out of bondage in Egypt, and then their conquest into the promised land. So when you first watched this, kind of what was your initial reaction to how he divided up this sequence and his strategy for kind of tackling this history, which is widely disregarded?
You mentioned that this history is disregarded. There's a lot of archaeologists today that throw out the biblical account because they say it doesn't match up with what we know from Egyptian history, right?
Right.
And so I think what was the most valuable in taking a look at this is that he doesn't just deal with the Exodus. He actually opens it up and looks all the way back into the book of Genesis, and then goes into the book of Exodus, as you mentioned, their arrival in Egypt. So that takes us back into the book of Genesis, which we've talked about in the past. How they grew and multiplied, that goes into the book of Genesis also. Then how they were enslaved, the Lord delivers them through Moses, brings judgment upon the Egyptians, delivers them from Egypt, and then how they get up into the land of Canaan. So it actually covers a period from Genesis into the book of Exodus, and actually takes us all the way up into the book of Joshua when the Lord delivers it into their hand. Right. So we're looking at a larger historical section or history, a subsection of history, and basically what he does is he says, when you look at all of these pieces and you line this up with what we know in not only Egyptian history but in other world history at that time frame, he said it all matches up. And that's what he's going to lay the evidence for in this video. 12 years it took him to do it too.
Yeah, I like that he is very thorough in his investigating and brings in both sides. I think he tries to show an unbiased view of the entire movie.
Right.
The entire documentary tries to show that he's just coming at this of wanting to understand, is it true or is it not? Can we base our faith in something that many people claim to have never existed? So in the beginning part of the film, he talked about three ancient Egyptian kingdoms. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, I think this is the biggest problem. Any student of Egyptian history recognizes or is going to be familiar with the three major kingdoms in Egypt. It starts back with the Old Kingdom, is followed then by a time of depression in Egypt, followed by a Middle Kingdom, followed by another time of depression, and then finally culminating in the New Kingdom. And basically what has happened is over the history of the study of archaeology and Egyptology, the majority of historians and archaeologists have placed the Exodus into the, or following the New Kingdom, the most recent of the kingdoms of Egypt. And do you remember why that was? Do you remember why it was? There was one key thing that he mentioned in the video that ties, or that they have used to tie the Exodus to the New Kingdom. Do you remember?
I believe they looked at Exodus, the early part of Exodus, where it talked about the Pharaoh Ramesses.
Yeah.
And they, because of that one verse mentioned there, they say, well, if you're going to believe that the Exodus is true, it has to be based off Ramesses, which is about 1250 BC before Christ was born. And then that's what they say. Well, that happened, that event of Ramesses. He lived during 1250 BC, which would be in this generally believed to be the New Kingdom.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? If you have watched any of the movies, whether they be cartoons or in reality, a lot of them will actually use that, don't they? They talk about Pharaoh Ramesses, who's supposed to be the big guy that rivals Moses.
Right. I just watched that with some students not too long ago, The Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston. It's
yeah.
all about Ramesses. It's all about that time period.
So you can see how, you know, even these – the and that's not a new movie. That's an older movie now. But since the late 1800s, early 1900s, they've dated it right around this time in the late 12th century going backwards before Christ. And what Mahoney is basically saying after his study and investigation, he said, we're placing the Exodus in the wrong era. He said, this really needs to be dated at the end of the Middle Kingdom, not the end of the New Kingdom.
Well, and I can see why even Christian archaeologists might believe that it might be during Ramesses, because Ramesses was supposed to be known from not just biblical writings but secular writings that he was like this great builder pharaoh.
Right.
And so, well, that would make sense that if he's building a lot of things that he used the Hebrew slaves to do that,
right.
Which totally makes sense, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the facts about the situation.
Yeah. So in his investigation then, what were some of the things that maybe struck you the most as far as what he uncovered archaeologically that sort of verifies that this would not have been taking place in the middle or the New Kingdom, but rather in the Middle Kingdom?
Well, I like the fact that he does take it in those six steps or stages, if you will, and he starts with their arrival in Egypt, and he lists some very clear evidence in his mind that you have that city of Ramesses II, and that since they've excavated further down underneath that city, they've actually found a city underneath that city, which is not unique. That often happens quite often, where a city is built on top of another city. And they find some very interesting things in the land of Goshen, where you have an Egyptian palace. That you have in this palace, where this land of Goshen, where you have 12 tribes, 12 pillars in this palace, and then there's 12 tombs as well. And within this people, within this land that seems to be Semitic, you know, the Jewish type people, there's this high-ranking Egyptian palace there. And among those 12 tombs, which seems to be kind of interesting because of the 12 tribes of Israel, you have one Egyptian tomb that has some incredible features about it. Do you want to talk about a little bit more of those?
Yeah.
The way he describes that?
Sure. So you get these 12 tombs, one for each one of the sons of Jacob, but one of the 12 tombs is different than the rest. It's in the shape of a pyramid. Now, it's not the same size as the pyramids that we're so familiar with in Egypt, but it demonstrates that this tomb was built for somebody who was very important in Egypt. And inside this pyramid-shaped tomb, as you go into it, there's a statue. And the statue has some interesting and very different features. So compared to the Egyptians, now remember, Egypt is in North Africa. Africans typically have a darker skin color. Well, this being that is in the statue form there that they're recognizing in this tomb has pale skin. So he doesn't have dark skin like an Egyptian would. It's a paler skin. He has red hair. Again, not something that you would see among Africans. Then in looking a little bit more closely at the statue, you can see that the statue is wearing a colored robe. What does that remind you of?
Joseph with his amazing robe from his father.
Yeah, you know, that's the whole thing in Genesis. We have the whole reason Joseph got in trouble with his brothers is because this many-colored robe that the Bible speaks of that his father had given to him. So you've got these interesting features. He also has something over his shoulder. It's called a throw stick, which the archaeologists say, he said, this is not something that the Egyptian rulers would have had. This is something that would have been a Syro-Canaanite type of
weapon. Yeah.
So four features, very, very different, but in an Egyptian tomb, and the fact that this is the 12 sons, there are also 12 pillars that were uncovered in the house, that Egyptian-style house that you talked about, 12 pillars, 12 tombs, one of which gets an Egyptian burial and a statue, and I think this is probably the most amazing thing of all. Do you remember what the most amazing thing of all of this last tomb was? What was missing?
Oh, there was no body.
There was no body. And so he asks the question. He says, well, wait a second. You know, wouldn't you expect that if they came and robbed it? He said, it wasn't robbed. The body was missing, but everything else was left untouched. This was not a grave robber. And he says, the other thing that he said is interesting. He said, if there was anything that a grave robber was gonna take, it wouldn't be the body. They'd leave the body. That's got no value at all.
Right.
So such an ironic thing. And why
would the body be gone, by the way?
That, I was going to ask you that, but Genesis tells us that Joseph, before he died, told his family, make sure that when you leave Egypt, you take my body with you. And the Exodus, so you have that statement in Genesis, and then the book of Exodus, when they leave, it tells us very clearly that he did take the body of Joseph with them. What an amazing thing. You think this is coincidence?
Yeah, there's too many things just in that one part.
In that one part.
What I also found was interesting that he talked about, and I was not aware of this until I went into some of this history through the video, but I didn't realize that there was this canal that was built up in that area too. And what do you remember about that?
Yeah, that they said as far back as you could possibly go, it's always been known the waterway of Joseph.
Wow. Yeah, and it connects like the biggest kind of lake there,
right,
to the Nile River, and so it's amazing. And then he goes on to talk about how the Pharaoh built his pyramid right next to this canal.
Right. And
again,
both of those things date to the Middle Kingdom. He says that the canal dates to the Middle Kingdom,
the New Kingdom of Ramesses.
Right, that's right. Not the New Kingdom.
A couple hundred years further back.
That's right. And the Pharaoh that you mentioned, who built his pyramid on the waterway there, that was Amenemhat III, and he was one of those rulers of the Middle Kingdom. And so they were saying that if the canal dates to the Middle Kingdom, and it was given that name, the canal or the waterway of Joseph, that again fits together with the fact that this is when the inhabitation of the children of Israel would have taken place in the Middle Kingdom rather than the New Kingdom.
You mentioned a little bit ago that this separate tomb showed Egyptian honor for someone among this foreign group of people, among those 12 nations. Their statue in there was twice as high as it normally would have been. Talk to me more about the pharaoh-type statues. And you mentioned Amenemhat earlier, the third. So what were some of the things that you've learned about the Egyptian sepulchres and those statues that they made, like how they looked and so forth?
Well, they obviously wanted to make their pharaohs godlike. They were gods. So they were very proud of them. But one of the interesting things that you learn about the pharaohs and their statues is that they would make them in a way that described their personality and aspects of their kingdom.
It's kind of cool.
It is. It's really interesting. And we learn a couple things about Amenemhat III in the way that they describe or depict him and his kingdom. Do you remember some of those things?
non-typical, right?
Because, yes, very non-typical from other...
Yeah, some of those things, I know they showed some pictures in the video, which I found fascinating, is they turned his ears out.
Yeah.
To kind of show that he was listening to the people in their distress, and he had weary, worn lines under his eyes, which they flashed a whole bunch of other Egyptian pharaoh's sepulchres, and none of them looked like that at all. So he looked... The sepulcher looked very worn, like he was tiresome, like he'd been through a very difficult process, which, again, if you go back to the biblical account, the 7 years of famine, you know, that he had a lot of people coming to him for help and support, and thank the Lord that he sent Joseph basically to deliver the whole region beyond Egypt, obviously into Canaan, because they, you know, his father and brothers came down. So this massive, almost maybe world famine at the time, you know, everyone came back to Egypt. Which also shows why Egypt became so wealthy and prosperous. They're the only ones who had food. They had the surplus. They had the monopoly when it came to grain and food, because the Lord gave Joseph the wisdom to plan for that.
And you know, those ears turned out, you know, very much describes that period of Genesis where we're told that the people kept coming to Joseph and to Pharaoh, you know, hey, we need this, we need this. And in the end, Egypt basically owned everything because of Joseph's plan. The people sold them, you know, everything that they had. They sold their land. Basically, when it was all done, Egypt owned everything. And they talked a little bit about that in the video too, about those. They had different
the other regions.
Yeah,
the other regions, rulers. Yep, and how they
shrunk.
Were basically equal in value, and then the pharaoh just dominated because of the wealth. And it's interesting too, because Egypt being the world power that most historians would agree with at that time, you know, they base all the history on that world power nation of Egypt, which was, you know, keeping track of writings and doing history and writing those things down. We'll talk about more of that history in a little bit here, but you know, you go from this arrival to Egypt, and the Lord incredibly blesses Joseph and his family, the 12 tribes of Israel, and they begin to multiply. That's the second stage that Mahoney gets into, is that the arrival of the Hebrews, the Israelites, Semitic people, into the land of Egypt. They're settling in there, and then they multiply like crazy, really.
Right. We're taking a look at, you know, when they moved to Egypt, the Bible tells us that they had 70 people. There were 70 people in the family. And by the time you get to the book of Exodus with the departure. Now, the book of Exodus only numbers the fighting men, but we can kind of estimate the number of the people of Israel. What would you give as an estimate for the number of people of Israel at this time when they're ready to leave Egypt?
Oh, at least 2 million, maybe 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5 million people. I mean, this multiplication. And this is prophetic from the book of Genesis, which we've talked about in the past too, right?
Yep.
That
Abraham, Isaac,
the Lord told him, I'm going to make your descendants as many as the stars, as many as the sand on the seashore. So the Lord fulfilled that. And we see archaeological evidence, not only there at that, it's called Avaris, that city that underlies what's called Ramses later on.
Right.
And they estimated that at a settlement of, you know, maybe 30,000 or so. Now, again, they're just estimating it. They don't have it all uncovered. It could be larger than that.
Right. They're guessing.
But throughout the land of Egypt, they found other settlements from the same era of slaves living in particular areas that were guarded by the Egyptians, that are Semitic in their ethnicity.
Because they can tell from the graves and the tools and weapons and things that they had. Yeah.
And, you know,
they're slaves too, just from, you know, it's amazing what they can tell from some of those things, like the bone structure and density. You know, they could tell that they were slaves because they're malnourished. But yeah, the idea of that, the enslavement there too, with the prosperity and the change of the from the prosperity one hand to the next. Can you explain a little bit more?
Sure. Well, this is one of the things that fits very nicely in that transition from when Joseph died. The book of Exodus tells us that a new ruler arose in Egypt that did not know Joseph, and he became intimidated by the children of Israel and then enslaved them. We talked about that.
You're looking at the third stage.
Yep, third stage, right? Now from arrival to multiplication, now to the enslavement or slavery. And we talked about that in our podcast with Moses, giving a little bit of this background. But the amazing things that they've uncovered, you know, they have, you could see evidence for the killing of the young people. Do you remember what we talked about in Exodus, when at first Pharaoh tried to just basically oppress the people.
Yep.
And he thought that that would drop their numbers. And the Bible tells us, no, they kept growing. They kept multiplying.
Yep. So the Egyptians were freaking out because their slaves were getting to be too many. They wouldn't be able to hold them off anymore if they wanted to revolt.
Right. And so then they began to kill off the children. And so they had basically an abortion policy that they put into place, and then they started killing off the baby boys. And what's interesting, and this was news to me, I had never heard this, but in those – you were talking about the looking at the bones and things, and they see these Harris lines that talk about – that indicate malnutrition, that they mm-hmm. weren't – so that's how they know that they were probably slaves, that they weren't getting everything that they needed. Then they have the average death – they can date the average death of those people in the tombs for between 32 and 34 years old. You know,
yeah.
The prime of life. They're getting beaten, and you know, so they're dying very early. Then you have the other information that talks about 50% of the graves that they have uncovered of this Semitic group, 50% of them, that's a huge number.
Right.
3 months of age or younger. Now, he gave some statistics.
So half of them are infants.
Half of them are infants.
Yeah.
This fits perfectly in what we see in the book of Exodus. And then you can also take a look at the other ones, that the adults that they've uncovered. The majority of them are females. So what happened? The baby boys were being killed and buried 3 months of age and younger. The adults, as they grew up, it was mostly women. And
right.
We're going to see that later on, too, with some of the other Egyptian documents that uncover feminine names for Semitic women. The 74% of the population of those names were Semitic and female.
Interesting. Yeah, it's neat the way he takes you through all these different evidences in all the stages, too.
Yeah.
It's not just like there's a bunch of evidence in one stage. No, it's in all six.
Right.
So we've gone through the first three. We've gone through the arrival, the multiplication of the Hebrew people, the enslavement. You know, when the Egyptians started getting pretty scared of them, the Pharaoh enslaved them. Joseph was long gone, so that honor and that relationship was gone. It was deceased. And so the newer Pharaoh has now said, okay, we got to do something about this problem. So God heard the cry of the people, and then the fourth stage, as you see in Exodus, laid out very clearly, is the judgment. What did Mahoney kind of describe when he comes to the evidence of the judgment that God brought? And we're talking about the plagues here, aren't we?
Right, yeah. And basically he describes, as you take a look at the biblical account, we see four areas of destruction. So number one, through the plagues that you mentioned, there was hail, there was locust, there was fire, all of these different things. And he says the first thing you're going to find is a loss of agriculture. Everything was destroyed, Exodus tells us. There were no crops left. The second was the 10th plague. Do you remember what the 10th plague was?
Death of the firstborn.
Okay, the death of the firstborn. So that was not only of human beings, but of all the animals. So if you have a death of all of the firstborn in an entire nation, that is going to decimate the population. Then, C, you have the loss of the slave force. If the Lord delivers his people, all of a sudden you have no slave force left. That's the people that are being used to build this kingdom. So you have loss
right.
of agriculture, loss of the firstborn sons, loss of the slave force. And then finally, the book of Exodus also tells us that Pharaoh, after the children of Israel left, what happened? He changed his mind. He changed his mind. He said, that was stupid. Why did I let him go?
Yeah, I'm going after him.
So he chases him down, and what happens to the army?
It's totally destroyed in the Red Sea.
Totally destroyed.
In fact, if you look at there in Exodus, it says that the children of Israel were able to see the bodies up on the banks
on
the beaches of the men that the Lord had just destroyed,
yep.
the military, which, again, historical context, like you said, shows that the Egyptians at this point in time lost their whole army, which made them very vulnerable then.
Right. And this is one of the other reasons that Mahoney and the other experts that he interviewed and dialogued with throughout this 12-year investigation, they are beginning to see, at least many of them, that this doesn't fit at the New Kingdom, but fits in the Middle Kingdom. There was a group of people that came in and took over Egypt, and there were a group of people called the Hyksos. They were a non-Egyptian people. And if you think about how decimated the land of Egypt would have been, it would have been perfect for a foreign group to come over and basically take over without a fight and conquer this nation. And so it fits very, very well in this earlier period, the Middle Kingdom. And if all of these other historians and archaeologists would understand, if they would open their eyes just a little bit and be open to another viewpoint, they would see how the history very clearly points to the Middle Kingdom instead of the New Kingdom.
Let's talk about that dating a little bit more, too, because he talks about a Bible passage that's very easy to skim over when it comes to the actual date of what the Bible says that this Exodus took place. Can you explain a little bit more?
Sure. In 1 Kings chapter 6, we have a number that's given, and it talks about the construction of the Temple of Solomon. So we know about when Solomon lives. And this passage says that Solomon began construction on the temple 480 years after the Exodus.
That's a pretty specific number, isn't it?
It is. And so what we can do now is based on the dating, we have the dating of David and the dating of Solomon, and based on that, we can back up 480 years. And guess what? It doesn't take us to the New Kingdom. It takes us to the Middle Kingdom. Now, It's not exactly where the Middle Kingdom is, and Mahoney talks a little bit about that too. What we have to do, and he gives evidence for this. He says that there are some periods in Egyptian history that basically we don't. It's during the low periods, and he says what we need to do is we need to move that up about 100 years. And if we take those periods out where we don't have any information, and we move the Egyptian timeline up 100 years, it fits perfectly with all of the archaeological evidence, with the numbers that we have from the book of Kings, and what we see in Genesis, Exodus, and Joshua. So it fits very nicely.
So between the judgment and the deliverance there, where the Lord leads them out of Exodus, what was the final stage there? You mentioned Joshua. He mentioned the final stage as being what?
The final stage is basically the conquest of Canaan. And there's a lot of other archaeological evidence. So from Egypt now, what Mahoney does is he actually goes into the Holy Land, the Promised Land, and he looks at the dating of the city of Jericho in the south and also the destruction of the city of Hebron up in the north. And those two, again, date prior to the New Kingdom. In other words, the children of Israel had to be settled in the Promised Land prior to the reign of King Ramses. And he has a couple of archaeological evidences. There's a papyrus. There is a stele, which is basically a big carved tablet that was a memorial to King Ramses. And it has there, the children of Israel are a people. They're a nation. Well, that doesn't make any sense if they were enslaved by Ramses and then ran off during his time.
Yeah, he wouldn't be bragging about that.
Right. So they've already got to be settled in the land of Canaan at this time. So again, it fits back prior to the New Kingdom, back to the time of the Middle Kingdom. And boy, I tell you what. What did you think about all of the evidence that was given for the destruction of Jericho, demonstrating the reliability of Joshua's
account? That is such a cool. You know, I'm a visual learner, so if you like that kind of like computer CIG, you know, graphics and stuff, CGI, whichever it is, if you like that kind of graphics, it's fascinating because he talks about how, you know, because it's an actual geographical site, Jericho, you know, these massive walls that are all crumbled down, you know, many people who deny the Bible and what happened there will say, well, there's a big earthquake.
Yeah.
You know, but it's interesting, too, because then the historians and the archaeologists will say, well, shortly after the walls came down, there was a fire that was set that had to have been set by enemies. So, okay, if I put this together correctly, the archaeologists are saying that the enemies surrounded them at the right time
while there's an earthquake
happened, while this earthquake happened, and then just after the earthquake happened, they were still in proper sorts, so they could go up there and set the city on fire. Even that has problems, because if you're going to siege a city, you have to kind of usually wait it out, or if you're waiting for an earthquake to happen, even if you could predict an earthquake.
Right.
They showed inside each of those homes, they found pots of grain, and in any siege, which usually lasts months and even up to a year, if not more, these grain pots were full and charred from this fire. So it shows that the siege that took place against the city of Jericho was very short, mm-hmm. possibly even days.
Right.
Which I think I've read about that somewhere.
Yep.
The 6 days that they marched around Jericho on the seventh day. They marched around seven times. The walls came crumbling down. And what's so fascinating to me is the way the walls came crumbling down. They can show that, and you can see the archaeological evidence is that they basically fell into a rampart so they could charge into the city.
Yeah.
What a stroke of luck, Lord.
What a coincidence, huh?
Yeah. It's crazy.
So there's one other interesting thing about Jericho, though, that also demonstrates the veracity of the biblical account. What was the other amazing thing about the account of Jericho that shows the account in connection with the wall?
Yeah, well, if you go back and what an interesting and exciting section to see the Lord's deliverance and helping his children reclaim their home. You know, that people from Jericho, squatters' rights, the Canaanites were gone. They came in there. The Lord was clearing out his house again. He's like, you go back in there, I'm going to give you your land back that I promised to your forefathers. And so as they're scouting out the land, if you remember the 12 spies and Rahab, the prostitute who knew the Lord, knew the people were afraid, and all the people were afraid of the God of Israel because of what had just happened in Egypt. She hid the spies and asked them to promise that they would spare her family. So she hung a red cord out her door, or out her window, which happened to be the only short wall of the entire city that had houses on it, and the only short wall in which the walls did not fall.
Again, coincidence?
I don't know. The earthquake could have probably happened. It's so amazing, you know, when you look at that, about that's exactly what the Bible shows us, and that's exactly what they find from archaeological evidence.
And that's, you know, Jesus tells us that even if they see a sign, they won't believe.
Right.
So we know that as we take a look at these signs, archaeological signs, so to speak, this isn't going to create faith in anybody.
No, we're looking. The one guy said he's biased. He thinks everyone's biased. And right. I would say I'm biased too. I'm looking from a biblical worldview because I believe in the true God, the triune God. People who deny God are going to look at this and say, it can't be this. It can't be dated then because I don't believe that took place. So it's just everyone has this bias about where their starting point is, what their worldview is, and it clouds the archaeological evidence that the Lord has clearly shown to us to show, no, these things really took place.
Yeah.
So what do you think the big problem today is, Nathaniel, when it comes to dating this Egyptian history? What do you think the big problem is when it comes to uncovering all these different things about that we find in the ground?
Well, I think
the past?
All the evidence is there. If we will open our eyes and say, oh, you know, I think part of it is, do people not want to give credibility to the Bible? Are they sticking to this old dating system because they don't want to give the Bible credibility, or are they worried that it's going to make themselves look bad? But when we take a look at the evidence, if we just take those gaps out of Egyptian history and are willing to move that just enough, and then recognize that the children of Israel aren't fitting into the new kingdom but the middle kingdom, as the evidence points to, everything falls into place. And he also says that this affects other ancient civilizations that have timing problems because they're based on the Egyptian history. And he said if we would just move that back, that 100 years, everything lines up and it all makes perfect sense.
Not just in Egyptian history, but in world history.
In Egyptian
the other surrounding
history,
nations.
Yep, Israelite history, the other Canaanite history, you know, other nations that interacted with Egypt. Once we put all of those things together, everybody has problems, and they've all had to adapt to the Egyptian history because they're not willing to change that. But he's saying the evidence is continuing to grow that they're going to need to have to change that. And once they do, everything's going to fit into place. And it verifies the history that God has recorded for us in his word. So it might not create faith in our hearts, but it does emphasize the fact that God's word is true. What he has promised, what he has revealed is accurate, and what he has told us and promised to us, he will follow through on and keep.
In my summary of the whole video, I really appreciate it. Again, coming from my worldview and belief about the truth of the Bible, it's so fun and interesting to see these evidences in the ground that they've uncovered and how they all tie together, and all six of these stages really point back to what they found in, as evidence that the Exodus really took place. And I think that Mahoney, the way he presents it is interesting. He doesn't go flip the head to the New Testament and talk about Jesus as the promised Messiah. Basically, his point is, okay, here's evidence here this part of the Bible is true. Believe the rest of it too. Go read the rest. He doesn't say that.
Right.
But he kind of left with that impression. Oh, this Exodus from the Bible really happened. It's a historical book. All these things really happened. I better read the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. If God is the author of history, we would expect that he would get his history correct. And
right.
What we learn from archaeology is that he does.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you – if you were to go about – would you recommend this movie? And if so or if not, why?
I would. Now, it's 2 hours long, so it is fairly long, and there is a lot of information in it. So I would encourage people to take a look at it. You can see the trailer online. If you go to patternsofevidence.com, you can see their trailer. You can find information about the actual video. I believe it is on Netflix, so people could watch it on Netflix if they wanted to. And if they're interested in a resource, when we worked on this, we went through this with our confirmation class since we've been going through the book of Exodus, we put together a quiz. So if anybody is interested in getting that quiz, send us an email at Burden and Blessing. We'll get that sent to you. And that might help you kind of pay attention to some of the things to focus on as you watch
it. It follows through the documentary, which at times some people might think are dry because it goes through so many facts. But if you have that sheet in front of you, it kind of gives an organized way of also looking at this too. I think that was very helpful for my students in that regard, and it helped me as well.
So what was your favorite thing about the video?
I really do think, since I'm so visual, I like the way he summarized each of the six stages with pictures. And here's the evidence here. He's showing graves, or he's showing tombs, or the 12 tombs, or the palace, or the lands, or the maps, all those different things that I love seeing in different Bible books, maps, and charts, and those things. I love all those different things, and he grouped them all together. He's laying it out as a plate or a platter. Here's the evidence that shows that this took place, and it's so much like the Bible. I like the computer graphics too, like I mentioned before, with Jericho especially, because I love that account from the Bible. And I just kind of like seeing how it all went down. It just makes it, for me, it made it a little bit more real. I know that some people don't look at it that way, but I like saying, oh, it's something I can picture and understand from a scientific standpoint, from a faith standpoint, from just a believer standpoint.
So it's more than just a dry documentary. He's going to have interviews in there, but he also has a lot of nice pictures, displays, graphics that illustrate what he is seeing, what he is hearing from these experts, and how it then relates to the biblical account and the historical account. And he does a nice job of that all the way through.
I agree. Did you have something similar?
That was probably my favorite thing too. I love history, so this was a no lose situation for me. I love history and archaeology and seeing how history comes to life. And he does a really great job in this video of bringing history to life and showing again how we can be confident that the history of the Bible is true. It's verified in the ground very clearly. So if you have any questions, go ahead, send us an email at burdenandblessing@gmail.com. Take a look at patternsofevidence.com for more information on the video, and share your thoughts with us too. If you have any thoughts or comments of other things that you'd like to see or like to have us review, don't hesitate to send that to us as well. May the Lord strengthen you and encourage you in the truth of His Word based on the evidence that is all around us and the truth of Christ.
We invite you to join us every week for another episode of Burden and Blessing Podcast, where we will continue to proclaim Jesus Christ as the one and only Savior for sinners. Until next week, take comfort in the fact that God is your rock and ever-present help in trouble.